So the title of the talk this evening is The Undivided Mind. The Undivided Mind. And when I was leaving the monastery, Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery in Thailand, for the last time, I had been teaching a little bit through the assistant abbot's pushing me in that direction. And so Ajahn Buddhadasa sort of gave me his final instructions. And he said, teach anatta, that's selflessness. And he says, don't be afraid to shake people up. So I think any time we approach a subject with depth, it does tend to shake people up. And tonight I want to approach that subject, but I want to approach it in terms of how our practice can orient itself when it's directed in the right way, with the right view. Because what I feel is that we can misdirect people and have them practice a long time under a misguided representation of the Dharma. But what does practice look like when up front we're aiming at anatta, selflessness? What does it look like? What does sitting look like? What does our effort look like? What does our intentionality look like? What does our view look like? How are we oriented and aligned with that particular point? Now, it doesn't mean that everyone here has had a deep experience of selflessness or emptiness or whatever, but it means that we can all orient ourselves to the truth of that, because that's the central teaching of the Buddha. Let's really be clear on that. Joseph talked about non-clinging, and non-clinging and selflessness are exactly the same thing. So let me just bring those two together for you. I was out just before coming over here, just looking out over the ocean, just being absolutely still in the mind. Move with me as I speak and you'll see. Let's just be still together, where the senses are alive and awake. And there's this enormous presence available. And the wonder, it's the interface is the interface of wonder. And there really isn't much of a sense of self in that. And then the thought came in, oh, I have to give a Dharma talk. And the whole thing ratcheted down to a very deliberate intention. In no way was that a misguided intention or something went wrong. The functional world comes in to navigate through, and we have to understand that I have to give a Dharma talk. And that sense of self then needs to navigate itself through that particular functionality and purpose with intention. But to understand the relativity of it. And may I just say that the less attached, the less the sense of self. The more attached, the greater the sense of self. Said differently, the greater the expanse of awareness, the less of the sense of me. The more the sense of me, the more the awareness becomes a kind of effortful relationship of me being mindful. And that sense of tension between me and mindfulness never gets settled, because they are counter-indications of one another. Right? So many of us begin our journey trying to be a self, me, being mindful. And that's the reason it's so difficult to maintain a relationship with mindfulness, because the presence of self is the absence of that very quality. And so we forget and then lament that we haven't tried hard enough. Trying harder, we try harder, and more of us come out and less availability to awareness. Isn't that amazing how we get caught in that kind of thing? And we all think we're going the right way with this. Now, it's really interesting. I had a dream a few years ago, several years ago, actually, and it was in my dream, I was on a board game, like Chutes and Ladders or Monopoly or something. And it was a very, I felt just incredibly labored, intensive board game. And I was, I think I was collecting money, but the money was, it was a dharmic board. And I remember thinking, oh, I've got to do this, and now I've got five more spaces before I can get to this, and then I have to do that. And suddenly, in this dream, I said, I'm not playing this game. I'm standing here on this spot. I'm not getting off the board, but I'm not going to collect anymore. That's it. And then I awoke. Not spiritually, but physically. And it, but their insight, it was really, really, sometimes it's interesting how insights can even ratchet down to your dreams, but this sense of, oh, whoa. Something's going on here that we need to pay attention to. Now, I just want us to get a sense of how this thing works. There's a principle that kind of, if we can understand this principle of Dharma, even theoretically, it changes the nature and way we practice. And it's not so, I mean, many people who work with the minds, therapists and others, understand some of the laws on which this principle is based. And because once we understand a principle, there's a whole set of laws that govern how we work with the mind. But unless we understand this principle, then we really do not understand how to work with the mind, and we find them through trial and error. And so many therapists have found their way into how to work with the mind, but not to the principle from which these laws are derived. Now, what's the principle? Once what principle is seen, the laws become obvious. So here's how I state it. And this whole way of orienting ourselves to the practice really has to do with stepping out of self-deception. Stepping out of self-deception is the governing direction for, always has been the governing direction of my meditation. So that's how I framed it. So what's the principle that has driven that orientation to practice? That you and I do not have a mind. We do not have a mind. No. The mind holds you. You do not have a mind. You are not out of your mind. You may be out of your mind's sanity, but you are not outside of your mind. You are not outside having the experience of mind. The mind is not something that happens to us. The sense of you and I is part of the mental processes of the mind and not separated from us. The mind and the sense of I are not two things. That is extraordinarily important, because the practice, all of practice, all of Dharma practice can go bifurcates at that junction. If you think you are outside of the mind and you have to do something to it, then the whole direction of the practice goes in one way. If you understand that the sense of you is a mental process, then there's a deviation at that juncture that is vast and significant. Again, some of you are looking very quizzically at me. I'm just get a sense. Just get a sense. Don't get upset. Just get a sense of where we're moving with this thing. I wouldn't lead you astray. So this fundamental shift in the understanding, at its heart, it's okay, if I'm not outside of the mind and then acting upon it as if I were, what is the force that takes us to awakening? You see, if it can't be me, there must be some force, some energetic force that takes me to where it is that I long to go. That's the key. We have to long to want to go there. We have to have the intentionality. Intention is the energetic motor that drives this whole thing. Let me show you up close how this works. We are sitting following the breath today. And suddenly you're not on the breath. Now, if you weren't just trying to distract yourself, it wasn't you that decided to leave your breath. It was the mind. It was just, you just left it, didn't you? It wasn't your fault, in other words. You just weren't there anymore. So to belittle yourself for not being there doesn't make much sense, does it? Because you have no power to stay there. See, try to belittle yourself to stay there. And you just hurt and you leave. Instead of just leaving, you'll hurt and leave. So that doesn't work. Now, suddenly, you awaken to the fact that you haven't been on the breath. You didn't wake yourself up and come back to the breath. You realized it after the fact that you'd already awakened. What woke you up? Intentionality drives this thing. And there are some amazing examples that I and others have experienced in terms of intentionality. Unconscious. You give your mind a direction, some place that you want to go, and it just goes there on its own. There are in deep states of some of the practices that we've done, you can say, I want to feel this for 5 minutes, then I want to feel that for 10 minutes, and then I'll wait until the next hour and I'll feel this for 3 minutes. And the thing does it. The mind just moves in that direction. Mysterious. Completely on its own. And you might have even forgotten that you had given it that wish. And there it goes. That force of mind, even in our more gross states of consciousness, still acts as a driving force. So it's important for us to know what we want. And you can't fool intention. You can't say, I really would like to want this, but what I really want to do is think myself into oblivion. If that's a deeper level, you will move off into that particular aspect of intentionality until we have sort of finished our enjoyment ride. And then that energy, after it is finished, will come back to the primary intention that each one of us have at some level, the primary intention to reconnect, to reconnect to the truth of things, to be free. So does that mean you're out of the picture? No. Now let me bring you back in. Okay? Because, you see, this whole thing works only according to your understanding. You have to honor wherever it is that we understand ourselves and where we can invest in our efforts, wherever we can say, okay, this is what I understand. I don't know what he's talking about, intentionality. All I know is that I'm not on the breath. Now, am I supposed to just say, that's that, and two halves of the mind fighting each other and all that? No, we bring our attention back because that's the level of understanding in which we can rejoin our experience, you see? So just wherever we understand how to rejoin, reconnect, Remember that the wise view is in terms of interconnectedness. And so effort made towards that view, towards reestablishing, rejoining, reconnecting with what's in front of our eyes. Whatever way we do, there's no absolute in this. It's relative according to the understanding we bring in that moment. So here's the way the mind has divided itself out, so that the sense of I and the mind are in constant tension to one another. The data comes in through the mind, through the senses, and is organized by the mind, and then a story or in a memory, recognition and memory and perception, and then a story filters out so that we understand what we're seeing and our relationship to what we see. And then we have a reaction. We've constructed that vision, and then we have a reaction to what we've constructed. And then the sense of I comes from the reactivity of what I think about what I would like to see and what is actually there for me to see. So the difference between how the mind organizes the data and what we would like, how we would like the mind to organize the data, are in conflict. And that conflict creates the sense that someone is outside of the experience having it. But it's still a mental process. It's still the mind, one mind, divided into two hemispheres. And the tension between that is the sense of self. We can be afraid of the data, or we can love the data, or we can be neutral about the data. And each of those will have a different sense of self in relationship to the data. You can't win this argument. You aren't going to be able to argue yourself out of the problem, of the vision. You can't willfully decide that you're not going to be dualistic in your response anymore, because that is more reactivity to the data that you see, further creating the division within the mind. Let's get the fundamentals down here. There's no better way to get trapped within duality than by trying to get out of it. This is a no-winner. So let me talk about the laws. Now we've got the principle. We get to, just theoretically, we get the sense of the principle. Let's look at some of the laws that come. Now I've just taken a few. They are endless. Endless laws. They're all fun and to be explored. Many of these you'll know, but they're kind of fun just to... Okay, so the first law that comes is from this principle, the more you avoid something, the more it ensures its return. Right? How can that not be? If there are two sides of the hemisphere, if you one side avoiding a thought, avoiding an experience, is not going to lead to the absence of either one. It's going to lead to more of a tension between the two, assuring the return of that experience. For instance, I would like everyone to sit and not think of the word apple. You can think of any other word, but the word apple, not going to work, is it? First word out of your thought would be apple. I had a great, when I was in Asia, I saw this insect that when I saw it, my whole body reacted to it. And I knew I'd had a karmic lifetimes with this insect. It was a centipede. And it was about 8 inches long. And they're not like centipedes over here. They're just, ugh. they have a bite that can kill a child. So I saw one. It had just rained. And I saw one scampering across my lawn and thought, oh, my God, I'm going to have some history with that thing, some future with that. And sure enough, one night I was lying in my cootie, my little cabin. I I heard some scratching around. I took my flashlight. 8 inches above my head was a centipede hanging by his legs, chewing on a scorpion. This far from my, I went, oh my God. And then later on I got bitten by one. No one else, monks all over the place, no one else had that experience with centipedes. They said, oh, you got bitten. Well, nobody gets bitten by those things. I got bitten by one. Because I had such a reaction to it. You see, the thing internally, you can see it work, but there's no, we have perceive a boundary between internal and external. But that's just a perceived boundary. It's an assumed boundary. When you alleviate that boundary, the same principles apply to relationship to what we call external and internal as internal to internal. The centipede and I were destined because of my reactivity to it. That was the karma link that brought us together. So this sense that avoidance creates a problem. You see, what I avoid, I charge with my fear. And since it's a mental experience that I'm trying to turn away from, now it becomes problematic. So I have created the problem through my reaction to an experience of the mind. The mind has created its own difficulty. And because it's so difficult for us to accept that accountability, we project it out. Oh, I have a problem with you, or I have a problem with this, or I have a problem with that. And as I have said many times, and Seattle Insight is very, we have to be radically accountable for ourselves and our reactions. We have to hold them completely, hermetically sealed. No leakage of externalizing our difficulties. As soon as we do, we're forever in turmoil with our own selves, but we don't perceive it that way. So what is being presented, whatever is presenting itself to us, we can't avoid it, we can't repress it, we can't deny it. That all those things add more tension and more division to the divided mind. Knowing that the division of mind itself against itself is the basic problem of me, me being here and everything else being outside myself. Are we aware that that's occurring? Or are we still externalizing our problems? Can we invite a different understanding to our mind so that we begin to meet the problem in a very different way? As long as we believe it's externalized, we will never be comfortable with it. But when we realize that if the mind is ever going to be whole and therefore undivided, we have to stop doing what we've been doing. We can't keep playing with this thing. It requires a deeper level of intentionality from us. It's like trying to decide, I'm not going to be angry anymore. You can't make that decision. You can only understand the anger as it's arising. So with that first law, the more you avoid something, the more you ensure its return, I also provide a skillful means of dealing with that schism. And that is, and everyone, that's all of our instructions in meditation are carved out from these laws. So if you can't avoid something willfully to get rid of it, what are we going to do? We can't deny it. We can't repress it. All of those are just different organizing the two halves of the hemispheres of the brain and different relationships to one another. Not getting rid of or solving the problem whatsoever. but creating more tension within the problem through our aversion, what's the skillful means that brings those two together? The skillful means is allowance and letting be. See, nothing dramatic here. Nothing dramatic here. But now, allowance and letting be, we don't really understand what that means. Because we still try to do it from the sense of me. And true letting go, what I call surrender, and I don't mean at the feet of gurus, I mean completely releasing, complete release, is that there's no problem at all. None. It's not a lingering concern. It's not a resignation. It's the end, problematic end. Like falling off a cliff. The second law. Okay, we're moving on here. Could spend an entire Dharma discourses on each of these. Just get a feeling for them. You cannot force the mind to bring forth what is hidden. Have you ever forgotten something? And you go, oh! And the more you try to remember what it was that you forgot, the more it stays buried. And then you start talking to somebody, forgetting about what you forgot, or even that you wanted to remember what you forgot, and then it pops back up like a cork in the ocean. That's how it works, isn't it? Go digging for it. You can't do it. Obvious, isn't it? When you know where the problem lies in terms of the principle of the mind pitted against itself. Another one is that many of us will have experiences throughout the retreat and or on other retreats that we would like to revisit. We'd like to bring them up again. We'd like to have them again. And sometimes whole retreats can be around something that you want to re-experience from some old retreat. And the retreat has failed because that old experience can't be contrived. That's obvious, isn't it? The one side of the mind can't, how is it going to do that? How's it, the pickaxe of one side of the mind going to dig out the treasure of the other? Emotions. People who have difficulty feeling emotions want to try to dig them out. I want to feel emotions for the first time. Well, keep the intention, but soften up a little. And just relax with it. And just say, and instead of trying to dig out emotions, allow yourself to be tender. And you can be tender very easily by just noticing the beauty of nature. Letting your heart feel tender. And when you get tender and you have the intention to want to feel the emotions, they will come. There's nothing wrong with anyone. Emotions will arise. And may I say that the level of sensitivity, the more tender we are, the more the two halves of the hemispheres come together. In appreciation. You see, when the two halves come together, they come together, and I don't want to romanticize this with something, but they come together in love. And the expression, because what can bring two halves together? Not your driving will. The fact is that they're already together. We just have to let them assume their natural orientation to one another by not prying them apart continually. And so the antidote or the application or the skillful means that we are trying to instill through metta is the willingness to be whole again, to see from wholeness instead of seeing from partisanship, instead of seeing the reasons I don't like you, which is just what my mind rebelling against itself. I look further, deeper, see what we have in common. Let me rejoin that experience with itself. And that happens through love. And relaxing. Relaxing has such a beautiful role to play in this whole meditation experience. Because we're relaxing the halves together. It's the tension and resistance that has kept them apart. When we are willing not to constantly impose our will upon one aspect of the experience or another, the sense of I hate myself or I hate what I'm seeing, the relaxation allows the original rejoining to take place again. The halves come back together through relaxation. You see, we're really not asking that much from us. It's just that we haven't learned how to work in cooperation with the basic principles by which the mind is built, on which the mind is built. And relaxation is a principle. Releasing tension, non-resistance, is the principle that brings the two hemispheres together again. The third law cannot eliminate anything through force of will. I know I'm taking away some honored strategies in your meditation. But you don't have to give them up. Just see they're not working. It's like being on that board game. You know, you get another $200 every time you pass go, but so what? You never get off the board. You just keep going around and around chasing your own tail. I want to get off the board. I want this thing to be finished. Let's figure out how to do this together. That's Sangha. And end this tension. End this. And it doesn't have to take lifetimes. It doesn't. But if we think it does, we love that. Why? Because our doubt gets appeased. If we doubt we're up to the task, then lifetimes is the perfect solution to awakening, isn't it? So rise up here. We can do this. The third law, or did I say the third law? Force of will. I've already said that one, but I'm going to talk a little bit more about it. This whole thing of effort. I love effort. Now, again, this is according, you have to apply the effort that is meaningful to you to apply, okay? But just see every step of the way, see its value, what it's doing for you, and also be open-minded and open attention to its limitation, what it's not doing for you. Every expression of effort has a limitation, okay? So don't assume that one size fits all for the rest of your life. You will grow in and out of the applications of effort and how and what effort means. Ultimately, effort has to be towards releasing, relaxing, relinquishing, and rejoining. Towards making the mind whole, not further subdivision. It has to be aligned with the principle by which the mind is working. So force of will, in the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha said, and I say this only because you probably don't believe me, all forms of effort are expressions of suffering. Now, does that mean there's no effort? No. The effort to rejoin something is to release the tension related to it. Right? The effort to relax, to relinquish our ideas about something. I have a whole talk on those particular expressions of effort. But basically it's we connecting, remember that the original view, even though we might not see it through our eyes, is that things are connected in ways that we do not assume. And that it's only the assumption of me, and an untested assumption of me, being outside of the world, that keeps me trying to influence my way back into it. If you, instead of trying to work it in that way, look at the assumptions on which the you is based. Instead of taking the assumptions as being true and working it from the strategy that those are true assumptions, look at the assumptions on which the truth is based. Pull the rug out from under it, in other words. What is this sense of me? And how does it build upon itself? It's awareness. Just be still together. And you can feel it. Not something alienated. It's not something that we own up here on this dais and you don't. From that level of stillness, you get glimpses. Oh, whoa, this is closer than I thought. So the other aspect of this law about cannot eliminate anything through force of will is a poor important one, and that you can't get rid of your suffering. So quit trying. So you have to understand that twist of, okay, so you can't get rid of your suffering by force of will. In fact, your force of will create, okay, so you just feel the tension. So how do we, what's the right a relationship to suffering? Well, we have to understand what creates the suffering, the tension, the not wanting it to be the way we want it to be, and the correction is dropping that view, dropping the resistance that we have. That's the way we correct it. But many of us, because we have so long labored under our own belief of ambition, we think we can do this thing and single-handedly through our strength, through our volition. It really requires a different orientation to experience itself. Stay with me, if you will. I know on the first day, no teacher likes to talk on the first night because the minds aren't there with us. So please try, just raise up, stay with me, stay with me. I won't go much longer. Fourth flaw, we cannot meet the mind with the same energy it is emitting. For instance, controlling the breath. So many times I hear people say, how do I stop controlling the breath? That's a conflict, that's an oxymoron. You can't stop controlling the breath. That's more control. You can't emit control to try to control what it is that's being controlled. You can just notice the control. See, awareness neutralizes the relationship. So instead of just trying to fight it, we just simply notice when we're controlling and notice when we're not controlling. And don't let either side of that equation upset us. So now I'm controlling. So now I'm not controlling. And if we don't, we come to not controlling. That's the way it works. But we actually have to take ourselves out of wanting one side or the other before the end shows itself. The application or the skillful means. Here, another one is songs going on in your head. right? Anyone had that one? Okay. You know the expression, face the music? Face the music is what you have to do here. Sorry, but you're singing along with it. If you look at it, you're either singing along with it or trying to run from the song. Either way, the song's going to continue. So you go right to the jukebox, stand there by the jukebox, and don't sing along. Just feel the music inside of you. Do not sing along. See, try it. You'll see how much you really want the thing to continue. Do-da, do-da. Okay, so we're going to move along here because we're getting late. The fifth law, I like this one. It's all or nothing. You can't leave any part of yourself behind. How could you? You would still have two, wouldn't you? This part of the mind pitted against that. It's all or nothing. It's a beautiful one because you see the Dharma is always inclusive, never exclusive. Never exclusive. And that's why it's so precious, because nothing is left out. Nothing. Now I know the Buddha said in his four great efforts to sustain, but if you look at where those four great efforts come from, sustaining the wholesome, encouraging the wholesome to arise, sustaining it once it has arisen, discouraging the unwholesome or unskillful from arising, and etc., that's really based in wisdom, not in aversion. Knowing that this isn't going to be beneficial. I'm not going to do this. I mean, that's just wise discrimination. That's just wise discernment. It's not based on attention. And many people take those four great efforts in terms of attention filled. Well, if it were attention filled, it would just subdivide. It doesn't work that way. That's not good dharma, right? This is an all or nothing thing. This whole thing. You see, once the mind comes together, once it's no longer pitted against itself, there's no longer you and I. It doesn't perceive from subject to object. It's presence, awareness. The sixth law, and final one that I'll talk about tonight, but first the skillful means of that last law, the law that it's all or nothing, the skillful means is inclusivity. Everything needs to be included. So when anything arises, if we meet it without reactivity, it can't sustain its fear or its desire because it's our turning towards or away that invests that quality in it. Do not move. In other words, do not cling. And it comes back in the fold. It's separated out because we want it. Don't move, and it comes back in. Not as a separate object from. And the sixth and final one that I want to talk about tonight is that we cannot strategize our way to freedom. Can't do that. This isn't a blueprint. What we do is we prepare the room, we sweep it clean, we keep it orderly and neat, and we leave the windows open. And if the wind blows, it blows. And if it doesn't blow, we still keep the windows open. And it will blow. And it blows not from our volition or from our wanting, It blows on its own. And it blows when the mind is whole. No longer creating fictional enemies. No longer seeing in terms of polarities. But quiet unto itself. Simple. Like the instructions we're giving. Not complicated. There's a law in physics or science. It's called the law of parsimony or parsimony. It's the law of elegance. It's something is so elegant that it has to be true. Look how beautiful this principle makes things. It's so elegant. It asks us really nothing. It asks the absence of what we're already doing. It asks the release of what we're already doing. It doesn't ask for something else from us. Doesn't that elegance, that sheer beauty, confirm its truth, even if we haven't experienced it? How could it not? And so our hearts are filled with the confidence, okay, I know this. I can do this. This can be done. And so may it all be done to all of us. Thank you. Can we sit for just a minute or two?